Thanks a lot, Don. I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation to speak. And what I'm discussing is primarily joint work with Rick Shane. All my nice colors are bleached out. Okay. Pardon? As we know, and as Rob Myers explained to us at the beginning of this program, higher dimensional gravity, in higher dimensional gravity, one is naturally led to consider questions about black holes in higher dimensions. And in this talk, we're going to be focusing on the issue of black hole topology in higher dimensions. And this has been a topic of interest to me for a long time. And the natural starting point for this discussion is Hawking's original theorem on black hole topology, which in very rough terms says the following: in a four-dimensional space-time obeying suitable energy conditions, the surface of a steady-state black hole is topologically a two-sphere. And Hawking also extended his result to apparent horizons in space-times, black hole space-times that aren't necessarily stationary. What I'd like to do is review these results of Hawking and then present an extension, a generalization of Hawking's theorems to higher dimension that Rick Shane and I have obtained. We know from the remarkable example of Emperon and Real of a black hole space-time having horizon topology S2 cross S1 that the conclusion in higher dimensions is not that black holes need to be spherical. In fact, it turns out that the natural condition in higher dimensions is that the surface of a black hole or apparent horizon must be of positive Ummoby type. That is, must admit a metric of strictly positive scalar curvature. This was known already in the time symmetric case. It follows from the Shane-Yau approach to the study of manifolds of positive scalar curvature of the minimal surface techniques. So what's really new about this work with Rick is that this conclusion of being positive Ummoby holds without any conditions on the extrinsic curvature of space. Now, as we know, there are many well-known restrictions. The conclusion of positive Ummoby implies many well-known restrictions on the topology, and we'll be reviewing some of those restrictions later on. Let me start by talking about Hawking's original black hole topology result, which says the following. Suppose we have a four-dimensional asymptotically flat stationary space-time in the usual sense, obeying the dominant energy condition, then cross-sections of the event horizon are necessarily spherical topologically S2. The event horizon here, just the usual setup, defined as the boundary of the past of future null infinity. By cross-section, I mean some closed two surface, say, obtained by intersecting the event horizon with a space-like hypersurface. And I want to say a few words about the proof. By stationarity, we know that our cross-section sigma is marginally outer trapped. That is, the outward null normals have zero, which just correspond to the generators of the horizon, have zero expansion. So we start at zero expansion. And then if one assumes that sigma is not a two-sphere, that it has genus greater than or equal to 1, then using the Gauss-Monnet theorem and the dominant energy theorem, Hawking showed how to deform sigma to the region outside the black hole region, outside the black holes, to a surface which is strictly outer trapped, meaning the outer null normals are strictly contracting in the mean. But this is forbidden by standard results in black holes. And so we get that it must be a two-sphere. Let me say just a bit more about the proof. I wanted to write on the chalkboard. So here's our cross-section sigma, and we consider the pass null hypersurface obtained by just generated by the pass null normal geodesics to sigma. And Hawking constructs a certain variation of sigma, sigma t, this is a one parameter deformation down along that pass null hypersurface. And if we let theta of t, just the scalar function, be the null expansion of the outward null normals, the optical scalar of sigma of t, then we know that initially that null expansion is zero, we're at sigma initially, and then Hawking derives a formula for the t derivative of theta at t equals zero, at sigma. And he shows that, assuming sigma's not a two-sphere, so its genus is greater than or equal to one.
Generally, theta could depend also on the location on the horizon.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's what is the partial derivative.
Okay. So it's not just the function of t necessarily.
Absolutely correct, and that's an important point. Yeah, it depends on the spatial point. And he drives a formula and shows that if sigma is not a two-sphere, genus greater than or equal to 1, using Gauss Bonnet and the dominant energy condition, that this derivative is strictly negative. And so that means for t, so since we're starting at 0, for t small, theta of t, this scalar function along sigma t, will be negative, which means sigma t is outer trapped. And so we arrive at a contradiction. Yeah.
So isn't there a sort of marginal case?
Yes, I was just getting to that. Right, you are. The torus is a borderline case for Hawking's argument. And in fact, in the torus case, so this is really only immediately true when the genus is strictly greater than one. In the case we're talking about a torus, you only get a weak inequality for this derivative, and so you're not immediately led to a contradiction. So the torus is borderline. It's kind of an annoying borderline case. But Hawking's argument implies certain things. So in the case that we have a torus, that can happen by Hawking's arguments only under very special circumstances. Sigma's got to be a flat torus. In addition to the null expansion vanishing, the shear's got to vanish. Certain energy momentum tensor must vanish. So you get a certain amount of rigidity in the torus case. Now there's more you can say about this situation. Yes, Gary?
Don't we know that the shear has to vanish anyway on the horizon? Or else the
if you're assuming that the generators are complete, yeah. So, of course, we're anticipating the apparent horizon situation as well, where the non-stationary case, where this would still apply. There's more you can say about this borderline case, but I really don't want to dwell on it. And let's just suffice to say that Hawking's argument shows that at least generically it's got to be a two-sphere. It's got to be a torus or a two-sphere, but the torus only under very special circumstances.
So, strictly speaking, the torus is not excluded as a possible horizon topology?
If you make enough assumptions, you can actually, if you impose enough assumptions, you can eliminate the torus case. Hawking did this in his original paper on black holes that appeared in Commune Math Phys. But there is not yet a sufficiently general result ruling. I don't believe there's a torus. I mean, in asymptotically flat spacetime, I don't think you can have a torus black hole. But there's not really a nice clean proof of that.
Well, as you said, that would be kind of the assumption to be
made. Right. But the assumptions that one can make are too strong, that it's, at least the ones I'm aware of at this point.
What about the cohomology arguments?
Yeah, so talking about topological censorship.
Yes.
Yes, I'm going to talk about that. Yeah, if you argue by topological censorship, you can eliminate the Torres case. That's true. Okay, so there is this sort of borderline case in the Hawking argument. You can show that you get much more rigidity, at least this is something Kai and I showed in the time symmetric case, which completely eliminates this borderline case. Problem with topological censorship, it doesn't successfully extend to higher dimensions. But anyway, I'll be talking about that
a bit later. Is there a requirement for positive energy in higher dimensions?
Pardon?
Is there a good reason for requiring positive energy in higher dimensions?
No, there's probably a question I can't answer very well.
Would something bad happen in our dimensions?
But there are scenarios in string theory, higher dimensional case, where the standard energy conditions are satisfied, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Most cases, in fact, I can argue that there are exceptions to that. Probably there are exceptions to these theorems, because in certain cases, the variables will be described in terms of higher dimensional smooth variables that also satisfy global boundary conditions of this connection.
Thank you. Thank you, Jens, for your comments. Still dealing with the four-dimensional case, and Hawking showed that his result also extends to apparent horizons. So I want to give the statement for apparent horizons here. The conclusion of his theorem holds for apparent horizons. So we're still dealing with a four-dimensional space-time. We've got a space-like hypersurface V. Sigma is a closed two-surface in V. And we assume sigma separates V, just so we have a notion of an inside and an outside. And then we say that sigma is an outer apparent horizon, provided it's marginally out of trap, so the expansion of the outward null normals vanishes, and so that there are no strictly outer trap surfaces outside of sigma. So this is what we mean by an outer apparent horizon. And heuristically, sigma is the outer limit of outer trap surfaces. And then in this situation, we have the following statement. If M4 is a space-time satisfying the dominant energy condition, and sigma is an outer apparent horizon in V, then sigma must be a two-sphere, generically. And the argument in this case is very similar. The distinction now is that we start with sigma having theta 0, and we do our deformation in space in V3. And so again, Hawking derives, one needs a formula for this time derivative of theta at t equals 0. And it's a similar formula, but it's a little different.
So what's going on then in these simulations of both t or d planes looking at these tutorial horizons?
Oh, that's...
horizons or event horizons?
Okay.
Do you get in trouble with those?
No, because... See, of course, that's a dynamical situation, but of course, with apparent horizons, you are allowing dynamical situations. But those examples are on the event horizon also. So in the dynamical case, the apparent horizon isn't on the event horizon. But anyway, right, the apparent horizon isn't on the horizon in the dynamical case, and these toroidal things are cross sections of the event horizon. But the real deal there is these are temporarily toroidal. They're down near where the dynamical horizon is just beginning. It's very non-regular there. There's all these crossovers. So that's what's making it possible. It's that horizon is a bit messy in the beginning. Once things settle down, even in their examples, they become they become two spheres. Okay. So these arguments actually assume that you have a smooth cross section. Okay.
So apparent horizons have to be spherical. Event horizons, when they settle down, have to be spherical, but they can be toroidal at the beginning. Is that the idea?
They can be anything at the beginning. No, because see, the initial part of an event horizon, you know, if it's a non-eternal event horizon, has all these crossover points, and there are these space-like portions of the event horizon, and you can sort of intersect them with a space-like hypersurface and get any topology you want.
Okay.
What's the cross-section? Where these null generators into the paths meet each other and leave the horizon. Yes. Boy, I'm getting a question about regularity from a physicist. that's a very good question. I will say this, topological censorship requires much less regularity than the Hawking arguments. Nothing, actually. Yeah, just about cross-sections of the event horizons. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, if you relax regularity. Okay.
I'm curious, is anyone checking carefully in your scenario to see whether in fact there are coronal triangles?
In which scenario?
The simulations by Kelsey.
That's a good question. I think I probably knew the answer to that at one time, but I don't remember. Do you remember?
I don't remember either. Yeah. I remember they were talking about some sort of toroidal horizons, but I don't even remember. I think they were event horizons.
No, they were definitely event horizons.
Anything about how many topologies about total
apparent. But maybe in the numerical simulations, maybe apparent horizons are toroidal. Actually, I don't remember. Yeah. You told me there'd be a lot of great questions.
A lot of pesky questions.
I have an hour and a half today? I'm just kidding. Let's see, where are we? Okay. this theorem includes the previous result for stationary black holes as a special case, because then in that case the cross sections in the stationary case are outer apparent horizons. And so anyway, our goal is to present a generalization of this theorem here. But before we get to that, as has already come up today, there's a completely different approach to the study of black hole topology based on the notion of topological censorship. And I'd like to say a little bit about that, since for some reason I've never had many opportunities to talk about this topic, which I like a lot. Getting ahead of myself there. So topological censorship was a topic developed in the 90s by Friedman, Schleit, Witt, Woolgar, myself, and others, with the original paper coming from Friedman, Schleit, and Witt. I'll try to make a long story short. So topological censorship has to do with the following idea. We know in GR, we know that non-trivial topological structures, like wormholes, tend to induce gravitational collapse. Wormholes pinch off and so on. And during the process of gravitational collapse, an event horizon forms, and that non-trivial topology ends up inside the black hole region. And so, from the point of view, if it didn't, if we're still outside, in the domain of outer communications, well, there'd be more gravitational collapse and more event horizon. And eventually, that topology ends up inside the black hole region. So from the point of view of topological censorship, that the domain of outer communication, the region outside of all black holes and white holes, should have simple topology. In this scenario, topological censorship is a consequence of cosmic censorship, because we're talking about an event horizon and forming and gravitational collapse and so on to hide the singularities. And so there are actually many results supporting this point of view, and perhaps the most basic result is the following. Suppose we have a four-dimensional asymptotically flat space-time obeying the null energy condition. So that's weaker than the dominant energy condition. And suppose that the domain of outer communication, the region outside of all black holes and white holes, is globally hyperbolic. That's the assumption that's basically imposing cosmic censorship. We don't have any naked singularities out here in the domain of outer communications. Then the domain of outer communications must be simply connected. So again, we're assuming a usual scry with the usual topology R cross S2.
It was to violate global hyperbolicity without singularities.
Well, of course, if you don't impose energy conditions, it's very simple. You can just pluck points out and things like that. Okay. This is pretty standard. This is a standard version of cosmic censorship. That space-time, or at least some region of space-time, is globally hyperbolic.
You can violate it in all sorts of ways. There's that little artificial event matters,
presumably you can violate it by allowing some complicated topology, but that's precisely what you're trying to prove.
No. Well, of course, you know, if you're creating closed time-like lines, that's sort of equivalent to creating some, that can be related to creating some bad topology, and then of course. Yeah.
But just taking funny topology and letting it collapse is not expected to violate.
Yeah, so this is, well, we can talk more about this point, but this is a fairly natural assumption. I mean, it's standard, for example, in these classical treatments of GR. So what we would like to do is take advantage of the simple connectivity of the domain of outer communication to derive some information about the event horizon. And let me explain how one implements this. We consider a two-sphere cut on scry minus, and we consider the future, time-like future, of that cut k on scry minus intersect the time-like path. That is, we consider a certain sub-region of the domain of outer communications dk, which is the region within the domain of outer communications, which is the future of this cut k. So dk is the intersection of the future of k intersect the past of scry plus. Because d is globally hyperbolic, the subregion dk to the future of k is also globally hyperbolic, and topological censorship applies equally well to the subregion dk. So dk is both globally hyperbolic and simply connected. Then we let V be a Cauchy surface for dk. And since dk is simply connected, we know in the globally hyperbolic case, all the topology is then in the Cauchy surfaces. The Cauchy surface V must be globally hyperbolic. Now we take the closure of V in the full spacetime M, and when you take the closure of V, you pick up a boundary here on the event horizon. You pick up a cross-section of the event horizon, at least that's what we expect to happen in nice situations. So the closure of V is actually a manifold with boundary V union sigma, where sigma is a cut or cross-section on the event horizon. And since V is simply connected, V closure is simply connected. V closure being simply connected implies that its boundary has to be a two-sphere. So this is the topological censorship argument that yields information about the topology of cross sections of the event horizon. And one might hope that you could extend this argument to higher dimensions. Topological censorship actually holds in all dimensions. As long as your scry is simply connected, the domain of outer communications will be simply connected. Topological censorship says more generally that at the fundamental group level, the topology of the domain of outer communications can be no more complicated than the topology of scry. It's simply connected.
Well, why should scry be simply connected to all the time dimensions? That's an assumption that we need. So,
well, of course, in these ADS, you know, these ADS black holes, you can have non-trivial topology of scry. Yeah. So then the whole.
Well, but I think in four dimensions, there are arguments that scry has to be next to cross
out. Yes, that's true, but in. Not those kind of arguments. That's true. Yeah.
Well, so hold on. I mean, you're saying that there's an argument for dimensions that is inconsistent to consider scry being RP2 cross on it, and need to be S2.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to put in some.
There may be some orientability assumptions.
If I can take some quotient to the flat space, that would surely satisfy the same. That's what I can do with wild things.
Yeah, I mean, there's this whole, there's this whole thing that, Bob Arrows used to do, Eric's involved in too, where you have this classification of things as, asymptotically flat, but not asymptotically Minkowski, or asymptotically Minkowski. Yes. Asymptotically flat, and you have S2 plus R, whatever it is. So there are all sorts of things that are, asymptotically flat and asymptotically.
Yeah, so of course this is this.
They don't satisfy some other conditions, that.
It's true. So this situation has been well studied by Garoche and Penrose, and Richard Newman studied it very carefully later. And so certainly under a certain set of conditions, the kind of examples you're thinking get ruled out. I mean, I forget, what's ruling it out offhand. But,
but generically, if I remember correctly, those types of arguments do make use of the fact that the cross-sections are two dimensions.
Oh, dimension's very important to the argument. Low dimension's very important to this argument, as I recall. Yeah.
So your question referred to different kinds of generalizations of topology of infinity, not just quotients of series.
Yeah.
It's still with zero cosmological constant.
Yeah.
Some condition that I roughly describe as asymptotically flat.
Yeah.
Of course, we're in kind of a tangent here to what I'm actually interested in presenting, which is sort of generalization of the Hawking approach. But here we're still talking about sort of topological censorship approach. And, at least in situations where scry is simply connected and the domain of outer communications is simply connected by top sen, one might hope that you can get topological information in higher dimensions but using topological censorship. But the problem is, Only in three spatial dimensions does the fundamental group sort of rule the topology. Once you go up one dimension to 4+1, where space is four-dimensional, then it's known that any closed orientable three-manifold is cobordant to the three-sphere through a simply connected space. So it doesn't appear like you can get any information from topological censorship once you move up to 4+1 dimensions. And at that point in time, when Schleich, Witt, Mulgar, and I were talking about these things, we sort of stopped thinking about it at this point. But I did want to mention that there's a recent paper by Oz and collaborators where they actually squeeze out some additional information about topological censorship in 5+1. And there, your horizons are four-dimensional, and so you have all the machinery of four-dimensional topology, Friedman classification, and so on. And they, if I have time, I'll mention at the end a bit about their result in this context in 5+1. But now I want to return to the setting of Hawking's theorem, but in arbitrary number of dimensions. So now we let M be, our spacetime be N plus 1 dimensional, Bn as a space-like hypersurface, sigma N minus 1 is a closed N minus 1 surface in Vn, and assume that sigma separates, so again we have a notion of inside and outside separates in Vn. We let B, let U be the unit future-directed time-like normal to Vn, and we let N be the unit normal to sigma as it sits inside V. And then we consider K equal U plus 1, and that gives us our outward directed null normal field along sigma. And, we introduce the so-called null second fundamental form associated with this null vector field K, and it's this bilinear form chi, and we take the trace of that null second fundamental form, and that gives us our null expansion or optical scalar along sigma with respect to the vector field K. Basically, this we know is just the divergence of K along sigma. We've scaled K in a specific way as the sum of two unit vectors, but we know that the sine of theta is independent of that scaling. And just as in the 3 plus 1 case, we say that sigma is an outer apparent horizon, provided it's marginally outer trapped, and there are no strictly outer trapped surfaces outside here in sigma. So it's sort of the outer limit of outer trapped surfaces. And then the theorem we have in this situation is if M satisfies the dominant energy condition and sigma is an outer apparent horizon in V, then sigma is of positive Yamabe type, admits symmetric of positive scalar curvature, except there's this borderline situation, unless all of these conditions hold. So sigma will be a positive Yamabe unless sigma is Ricci flat, which means flat, for example, if N is dimension 3 or 4. If that null second fundamental form vanishes on sigma, and if this energy momentum tensor term vanishes along sigma, this is a misprint that should be a K. So again, there are some things you can say in this borderline case, and I think there's approaches what I would consider satisfactory approaches to eliminate the borderline case. But in any case, what we have here is generically sigma's got to be a positive Yamabe type. And being a positive Yamabe type, as we mentioned in the introduction, implies a lot of topological restrictions. There are many known topological obstructions to the existence of positive scalar curvature metrics, beginning with the famous result of Lichner-Wish on the vanishing of the A roof genus. Then a key advance was made in this problem in the late 70s and early 80s by Shane Yao and Gromov-Lawson. And for the moment, let me focus attention on the space-time 4 plus 1 case where our apparent horizon has dimension 3. I'm going to need to write a little bit on the chalkboard again. And so let's assume sigma is orientable. Then we know by the prime decomposition theorem, any closed orientable 3 manifold can be written as a connected sum of spherical spaces. That is homotopy 3 spheres, or 3 spheres if the Poincaré conjecture holds, perhaps with identifications, spherical spaces. S2 cross S1s, and K pi 1 manifolds. We have this connected sum decomposition for orientable, closed orientable 3 manifolds. But from the work of Shane Yao and Gromov-Lawson, we know that if sigma emits a metric of positive scalar curvature, recall k pi 1 is a space whose universal cover is contractible, like the torus, something like that. So from the work of Shane Yao, Gromov-Lawson, we know that there can be, if sigma carries a metric of positive scalar curvature, there can be no k pi 1s in its connected sum decomposition. And so we're left with the following situation. If sigma is a closed orientable three manifold of positive Umabi type, then it must be a connected sum of spherical manifolds and S2 cross S1s. So, yes?
So if I assign the original induced metric on the cross-section mean and close to scalar curvature,
that's a very good point. I'm not even to say positive Umabi type. It doesn't even have to be conformal to. I'm certainly not talking about the. Yes. So to say it admits a metric of positive scalar curvature, we're certainly not saying that the induced metric.
So what is the relation between that metric of positive scalar curvature and the actual simple relation?
Oh well, but so usually this is achieved by a conformal rescaling. Okay. So our basic topologies in the case of three-dimensional horizons, horizon sections, parent horizons, are S3 and S2 cross S1. And of course, we now we have non-trivial examples realizing the S2 cross S1 case as well as the S3 case. Yeah, so if we have a black hole horizon, cut out a little ball and glue the two spheres together. Is there a connected sum? A lot of connected sum results in geometry. Can we have a connected sum result for black holes to get an S2 cross, connected sum of two S2 cross S1s? Yeah, it sounds very it's very non-homogeneous, very non-homogeneous, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
If you set up initial conditions with the connected sum of two S2 cross S1s, yeah.
Oh, so you think maybe if
it radiates down, it would just be surrounded by a sphere and become spherical.
Oh, I see.
Of course, it doesn't. You can have a P3, so you know S3 is a special. You know, you basically got yes. Everything's built out of spherical spaces and S2 cross S1s. Now it's true a spherical space isn't S3. Modulo Poincaré conjecture, which probably is true now. It's S3, perhaps with identifications.
Well, we don't know that all of these things arise, right?
Nothing else arises. So that's right. Yeah. We're getting right. So at the end, I'll mention, we're 4 plus 1, make some comment about 5 plus 1. But there is a result about topological restrictions, that that holds in arbitrary dimensions. And this is a result of Gromov-Lawson. The compact manifold emits a metric of non-positive sectional curvature, then it cannot carry a metric of positive scalar curvature. It can't be positive Umabi. So all your favorite examples that admit such metrics are ruled out here. Okay. Products of surfaces of genus G. Can't admit metrics of positive scalar curvature and so on. So you know there's a curvature associated with each in a manifold Riemannian manifold with each plane there's a curvature associated with that, You look at a little geodesic surface at that point, geodesic cap, and you look at the Gaussian curvature of that geodesic cap, that's the sectional curvature. So it's something constructed on each plane from the Riemann tensor on each plane of the tangent space at a given point. Okay.
Another way to say it is if you look at the Riemann tensor with two up and two down, that's a map from two forms to two points. Yes, just take the eigenvalues of that map. Okay.
Good. I have to admit I never think of sectional curvature that way, but it's true. This is more a mathematician's right quantity. So we have this this statement of this generalization of Hawking's theorem, and I'd like to say a few words about the proof. So we're looking at this outer apparent horizon sigma, and the goal is to show that it carries a metric of positive scalar curvature. And how are we going to get that? Well, it is achieved through a conformal rescaling of the metric. How do we get the conformal factor? Takes a little bit of work. But the proof in the beginning starts out somewhat like Hawking's theorem. So we consider in our space like hypersurface V, we consider a one parameter variation or deformation of sigma with variation vector field, which is just sort of the first derivative of the variation at t equals zero, equal to phi times n. In other words, we're considering what are called normal variations with vector field, a scalar multiple of the unit normal to sigma within V. Phi here is any smooth function on sigma, which basically determines the variation. And we let theta of t be the null expansion of sigma t, where the null vector field we're using here is u plus nt, where nt is the outward unit normal field to sigma t in V. As Kai and I observed in the time symmetric case, and as Anderson, Mars, and Simone extended to the non-time symmetric case, the fact that there are no outer trapped surfaces outside of sigma implies that there exists a normal variation of sigma with phi strictly positive, and this derivative everywhere along sigma non-negative. So heuristically, the idea is if we can't have d theta dt negative, because then we'd be getting some outer trapped surface outside of sigma. But the point is, this condition actually does hold pointwise. And then once we at this point, we then need a formula for d theta dt that's relevant to the situation at hand. Hawking did it in four dimensions using Newman-Penrose, and that's not so helpful when we go into higher dimensions. But Kai and I made this computation a few years ago. Here's the formula for d theta dt at t equals zero. And I alluded to this work of Anderson, Mars, and Simone, which is a recent paper on dynamical horizons. They need this formula. They need a formula for d theta dt also. And I was relieved to see that our two expressions agree when I look carefully at the paper. So this stuff on the right-hand side lives on sigma. Q is a scalar quantity. It involves the scalar curvature of the ambient space, scalar curvature of V, and energy momentum tensor term, and the square of this null second fundamental form. So these two terms come in with a sign, and it turns out to be just the right sign for the argument. X is some vector field on sigma. It's not so important what it is. But notice this expression, what we have here is really maybe viewed as a second order linear elliptic because of the Laplacian there, second order linear elliptic operator acting on phi. And when the vector field X vanishes, in the time symmetric case, the vector field X will vanish, and this operator reduces just to the classical stability operator of minimal surface theory. Which is to be expected, because in the time symmetric case, the null expansion theta just becomes the mean curvature of these surfaces in V. Anyway, since we know our variation for our, we're able to establish the existence of a variation having d theta dt greater than or equal to zero. So this expression is greater than or equal to zero. When you complete the square, gives us this expression is greater than or equal to zero. And then when we set u equal ln phi, which we can because phi is strictly positive, we obtain this inequality. Now, if you take this inequality and you integrate over sigma, of course the Laplacian term drops out, divergence term drops out, and if you substitute in for what q is, when you integrate over this inequality over sigma, you get the statement that the integral of the scalar curvature of sigma, that is the total scalar curvature of sigma, is non-negative. If you're in 3 plus 1 dimension, so that sigma is two-dimensional, then Gauss-Binet, and non-negative actually, except under special circumstances, strictly positive. So if you're in 3 plus 1, where sigma is two-dimensional, you get that sigma is a two-sphere. And in fact, this is essentially originally Hawking's original argument. But in higher dimensions, of course, the total scalar curvature in and of itself, being positive, doesn't say anything about the topology of the manifold. And so one needs to do something else. So this, in the time-symmetric case, this divergent term drops away. In this situation, we're in the 3 plus 1 case, we're only interested in the integral of this quantity, it drops away. But the problem in higher dimensions is actually dealing with this divergence term, div x. Then if we, I don't have actually too much detail here, but we can take this Laplacian term, div grad u, and put it into that divergence term. And so we have this inequality, and we've absorbed the Laplacian term into this divergence term, and then just set y equal x minus grad u, and we have this inequality here. And then a little miracle occurs at this point. It's a simple estimate that we multiply through by a test function psi, actually psi squared, where psi is any smooth function on sigma. And you do a little integration by parts or product rule and Schwarz inequality and integrate over sigma. And at the end of the day, you see that you get an inequality for psi involving the scalar q, but x is gone. And one immediately sees from this inequality, from the variational characterization of the first eigenvalue of self-adjoint operators, this inequality holding for all psi implies that the first eigenvalue of the operator minus Laplacian plus q is non-negative. And what's happened here is we have basically reduced the situation to the time-symmetric case. We're looking at an operator here. This is precisely the operator you get when you set x equal to zero. So once we know that the first eigenvalue of this operator is non-negative, we're actually in a very familiar situation. And this is a self-adjoint operator. Its first eigenvalue is non-negative. There'll be a corresponding eigenfunction which is strictly positive, and this is fairly standard stuff at this point. When you rescale the metric g by an appropriate power of this eigenfunction f, you actually get a metric of non-negative scalar curvature, which in fact is strictly positive, except under special circumstances. So that's a bit of commentary on the proof of the result. So
basically, the scalar curvature of sigma.
Pardon?
Is q basically the scalar curvature of sigma?
Okay, so it's actually, basically, there it is. This is the scalar curvature of the spatial part. And we don't have control on the sign of that term, but when you do the conformal rescaling, you can pick it so it disappears, and what results is just non-negative terms appearing in the conformal rescaling. So this part of the argument works really like things Shane and Yao were doing 25 years ago, looking at manifolds of non-negative scalar curvature. Manifolds of positive scalar curvature. Yeah, we just are dealing with what we're calling outer apparent horizons. Yeah.
Greg, you mentioned something about the total scalar curvature and it didn't give you enough information about topology. I'm trying to remember some old stuff by Kazin and Warner where they showed that if total scalar curvature in certain circumstances had a sign, you could do a informal reading. Do you know what I'm talking about? Maybe misremembering is the problem.
Do you know what the, yeah, I mean, do you know what dimension they were working in? Arbitrary?
In the Amavi problem, in arbitrary dimension,
yeah.
Whether they had results in arbitrary.
But
It might have been kind of
yeah, in fact, certainly the old Chen Yao arguments were certainly influenced by those Kasdan-Warner arguments. It is a fact that you give me any three manifold, any three manifold, any closed N manifold, Riemannian N manifold, I can put a metric on it so that its integrated scalar curvature is positive. Because you can put on big bubbles of two, you can sort of do these connected sum operations and put on big bubbles of, or spheres. Okay. So the scalar curvature being, the integrated scalar curvature being positive really gives no information about the topology. Then just to wrap up, I wanted to make a couple of comments about the situation in 5 plus 1 dimensions.
So just to come back, the assumption of asymptotic flatness,
in this proof here. Okay, so once we brought it down to the level, it's a good question, once we brought it down to the level of outer apparent horizons, it plays no role whatsoever. So the argument is essentially completely local. Okay. Once you assume you have a surface with theta equals zero, and there's no theta negative outside with respect to that's all it takes. Okay. Pardon? Yeah, but then the dominant energy condition doesn't hold.
Well, you need the dominant energy condition. Yeah.
You're exactly right. Because of course we know we have higher genus, and right in the asymptotically ADS case, we have higher genus black holes. Yeah. Yeah. So you need the dominant energy condition. Yeah. On the other hand, topological censorship does say something about this situation when you have higher in the asymptotically ADS, because you only need null energy condition. And topological censorship says, say in 3 plus 1 asymptotically locally ADS, that the genus of the horizon must be less than or equal to the genus of the topology at infinity. So just a brief comment here about the situation in 5 plus 1 dimensions where our horizon is four-dimensional. We know from Seibert-Witten theory that there are many examples of compact four-manifolds, even simply connected ones, that did not admit metrics of positive scalar curvature. So the Seibert-Witten invariant is an obstruction to positive scalar curvature. And many algebraic surfaces, complex algebraic surfaces, have non-vanishing Seibert-Witten invariant. So many of these are simply connected examples. So many of these are not positive Umami. So they, according in the context of these theorems, they couldn't appear as our black hole topology. But then I wanted to come back to this recent paper of Oz and collaborators, where they use topological censorship to argue that if the horizon is simply four-dimensional horizon is simply connected, and there are many such examples, then either it's got to be homeomorphic to a four-sphere, or connected sum of S2 cross S2s. Okay. So, in the context of simply connected horizons, they arrive at an interesting conclusion, and their arguments, in addition to what you get from topological censorship, involves four-manifold topology and cobordism theory. And with that, I think I'll stop. Thank you.
So I have to talk about the three torus.
Pardon?
The three torus. So if I get there, and it's allowed to have a three torus, but we know it would have to be flat.
Right.
But then us they claim that the average curvature on the spatial class to the horizon has to be none, has to be strictly positive. So that seems to exclude the fixings. But is the marginal case on that case? Also?
They've completely disregarded the marginal case. They're just, it's incorrect. They incorrectly disregarded the marginal case. I wrote to them about it, but they didn't do anything about it.
So I'd also like to ask, I mean, you sort of put in this word generic to get, but of course, you know, we don't know that many examples of stationary black holes, and probably only a few, and so it seems like every one is going to be of interest. So even if there's just one special case where you have a coronal horizon, we'd all be very excited.
And almost all our examples are not generic, right? They're very special. They're very special.
So if you could just focus, now you said there were some other assumptions you could make and rule out this case. So what kind of other assumptions do
okay.
you have to say? Can I ask a question? If we're talking about the results of larger horizons, right, then generic should be okay, because if I have a stationary solution which has a funny curvature, I should presumably be able to curve. It's like, So generic really shouldn't allow, you know, these kind of trials. But at the very least, it tells you that it can't possibly be safe. And if we go safe in a very dramatic and interesting way, it changes probably.
In the time symmetric case, so if we actually restrict to static black holes, then there's work of Kai and I that shows when you're in the borderline case, you get this infinitesimal rigidity from Hawking's statement. It's got to be flat, and things have to vanish at sigma. What Kai and I show is that you actually get a product structure of sigma cross an interval, where each thing in the product is has theta equal to zero, marginally trapped. And this product goes into the domain of outer communications. And that's not permitted by standard results in black holes. So in the time symmetric or static case, we just get a clear rule out from essentially a local argument, because we can prove stronger rigidity. We actually get a product structure in there, and all those sigmas in the product structure have theta equal to zero. And they're outside in the domain of outer communications, and you can't have that. So that handles the time symmetric case. There's an old result of Shane and Yao, but I have to sort of understand this a little better. From their sort of second paper on their proof of the positive mass theorem, when they eliminate the maximal assumption, they need some strict inequalities in the arguments that appear there. And in fact, some of the arguments that appear there motivated was sort of an inspiration for some of the arguments that appear here. But they have a result, so from the very beginning, initial data result, that they can perturb the initial data a little bit. By perturb a little bit here, that means just changing the mass a little bit, ADM mass a little bit, so that the dominant energy condition becomes strict. And then, so that is some suggestion already about stability, that would immediately, by a small perturbation initial data, you knock out these borderline cases. Yeah.
I had a question about the stationary case. So in that case, what is now through the mass in your rotation of Hering field? So if you know you have a rotation of Hering field and the pad when you call the amount of time, does that give you stronger constraints on your possible quality?
It might. If you look at some reduction or something like this, I mean, maybe that you can do a sort of dimensional reduction or something.
Yeah.
You have something here and reduce it down to something where you have more control or something.
Yeah.
If you look at lower dimensions instead of higher dimensions, plus one, you're supposed to be this result, I think, called Lewis theorem about no black holes.
Right.
What does that mean?
So you can't have apparent horizons. You can't have outer apparent horizons in that case in 2+1. And it's exactly Hawking's argument run through in 2+1. But the point is, see, to get a conclusion from Hawking's argument, you had to apply Gauss-Bonnet. But in 2+1, you don't need Gauss-Binet. So the statement isn't you can't have higher genus things. The statement is you just can't have anything.
There's also the marginal case.
There's still the marginal case.
The space energy has to vanish on the marginal surfaces just by that organism. If you assume some kind of stability or genericity, then
yeah, I mean, Lars and I are sort of looking at the marginal case, so it would be nice to know an exact statement of whether there is a marginal case, and if so.
I think you and I have talked about this. There's going to be more rigidity in these marginal cases that's going to rule out everything. I mean, this is what I believe. This is what Kai and I have shown in the time symmetric case, but I believe, and Lars and I have talked about this, you're going to get this kind of rigidity I was talking about. This is what we expect in the non-time symmetric case as well. There's got to be a nice clean argument that rules out these marginal cases or borderline cases.
A classification
or characterization of that situation, the borderline case. Yeah.
People seem to think that black holes are excluded in the so-called U1 cosmological solution. Well, you're 3+1, but you have a space like U1 symmetry.
I'm familiar with those papers.
You have a 2+1 gravity coupled to certain special types of matter. I mean,
where the relevant energy conditions still hold.
Yeah.
And then this other 2+1 result kicks in. Right.
That's exactly the situation where this ENS result applies.
And you have the strictness there. Generically, you do. Yeah. Generically, yeah.
Maybe just a comment. I mean, you talked about the restrictions on the topology for 3- and 4-dimensional horizons, but in some dimensions, you know, positive scalar curvature is sort of easy to achieve. There's basically no restriction. Like 6 and 7 dimensions, I think every simply connected manifold will get symmetric of positive scalar curvature.
That's right. 5, 6, and 7. If we restrict to simply connected horizons, then being positive Umabi doesn't give any additional information, because every simply connected in 5, 6, 7 dimensions, you're right, admits a metric of positive.
So in any case, there might be much more exotic black holes if you go up a few more.
It's the dimension of the horizon.
No, I'm just thinking it means that you don't know any reason why you'd be alluding to this.
Yeah, so there's.
There might be further constraints that you don't write.
I agree with you completely. Positive Umabi is not the end of the story, especially in the simply connected case. No. Well, actually, in the non-spin case, it's true in all dimensions. In the non-spin case, all non-spin manifolds of dimension greater or equal to 5 admit metrics of positive scalar curvature. And in the spin case, there's this thing that has to vanish.
Any more questions for Greg?
Thank you.